Blog Talk Radio.
This is from Kelly, Kelly, Kelly Manjaro, Tanzania. Come on, you put your heads on all the people here, man. Gonna throw everywhere in Africa. Why, see, I'm gonna tell you about home.
You wanna hear about what I wanna tell about? Nataka kusikia, nachotaka kuongea.
Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. From time to time, we will have a special presentation on a variety of topics. Homeopathy is a show hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brooks. Please contact HWC if you would like to help support the show as a sustaining member or have suggestions for future shows. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your questions. Please share by tweeting on Twitter, posting on Facebook and MySpace, and all other social networks. You may select the widget and place the player on your blog or website. With gratitude to all our listeners, let's go!
Hi, I'm Debbie Brooke, founder of Homeopathy World Community. I'm speaking with a special guest tonight, Kate Birch, who is a homeopath and an author. She has written extensively about vaccinations, the vaccination issue, contagious disease, and how to stay healthy, really. She's a mother of two children, a homeopath, and a massage therapist. She came to homeopathy when she was a young mother for the treatment of depression, weight loss, and weakness. And you can read a lot more about her on her website. She has witnessed the suffering of asthma after vaccinations and then decided not to vaccinate her daughter. After successful treatment with homeopathy for the family, she went to school to become a homeopath. Kate has been in homeopathic family practice since 1994 and over 500 hours of teaching homeopathy in the classroom and lecture settings. I usually see that she travels all over the world, especially to India, and from 2005 to 2008, she served as the vice president of the North American Society of Homeopaths and remains the North American representative to the International Council for Homeopathy. And Kate is on the line with us this evening for all our listeners to get introduced to her and learn about her extensive experience. Hi, Kate.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you loud and clear.
All right. Okay, good. I'm so happy to be here.
Glad to have you. We wanted to also introduce to the people that you have written, I'm holding in my hand a copy of your book. It weighs, I don't know, have you ever put it on a scale? It's really heavy.
Yeah.
You probably
must. Only a pound or two.
It's only a pound?
Well, it's something like that, a pound or two maybe, I'm not sure.
It's... sure feels a lot more than a stick of butter or a pound of butter. I guess if you go to the post office and mail it, they'll tell you how much it weighs, but it is a hefty volume that has much information that people need to start reading about and learning for themselves about homeopathy and the vaccination issue. And you have a really glowing foreword by Randall Neustadter, who is also a homeopath. And maybe at some point we'll read a little of that. But
yep.
Today we have a certain number of things that we wanted to talk about. First, about your book. And then we also wanted to answer some questions that people have about why we should look at the vaccine issue today. So many people are opting out. And what homeopathy can do to prevent disease as a prophylaxis, I imagine. And
yep.
And in general, what is our view of disease, and to look at what we're supposedly supposed to give to our children, at what age and how frequently, and the number of vaccines that we're giving out today. So you've taken a really, you focused your life's work on this issue, so I think we can learn a lot from you.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
Yeah, so why don't you just tell us more about the beginning of your book and how, why you wrote it and the development and evolution of this publication.
Yeah. So as you were reading from the back of the book, you know, my son experienced asthma as a result of his vaccination, and I decided to not vaccinate my daughter when she was born. She's now 18, and she's perfectly happy, healthy, and free. And I've, over the years, listened to the concerns of my patients wanting to keep their children healthy. Was vaccination the way to go, and what to do if they didn't vaccinate? And really from not direct questioning, but after providing answers like, oh, yes, homeopathy can help, or, you know, yes, there's homeopathy has a rich history of treating infectious disease, I felt that, those answers weren't sufficient, and the, you know, gentle looking at my bookshelf, oh, yes, there's all kinds of literature about how homeopathy can treat infectious disease. I didn't find the answer sufficient enough for my patients, and so I decided to write a book. And so the book is Vaccine-Free Prevention and Treatment of Infectious Contagious Disease with Homeopathy. And the book is available in North America. It's available in Europe. And it also has an Indian edition that's available so in India and Africa. And it's currently in English and translated into German. And there's a Japanese translation that is about to get underway, and various other interests for Spanish translation and French and so on and so forth. I really think that the book comes at an important time where what used to be seemingly sound healthcare policy of vaccination in the last 10 years has really become something different. And it's driving parents, partly from the results of it, partly from fear, making them ask questions about what to do differently. And so this book is written for practitioners. It's also written for the mother who says, you know, I really just don't feel like I want to vaccinate my child, but she has no information to base that feeling on. And it's written in very simple language so that a mother can read it and say, oh, if I don't vaccinate, well, look, homeopathy has an option for me. And in the book is a general overview of the immune system and health and what we're looking at. And then there's all the chapters on chickenpox, mumps, measles, whooping cough, pneumonia, all the things that children get vaccines for or don't get vaccines for, but then also how you can treat them with homeopathy. And there's also a travel section for tropical diseases, and the sexually transmitted diseases are included in that book too.
It is complete.
Yes.
It is really complete. So probably people would, if we had listeners today, we would probably have a bunch of questions, but it's maybe dinner time or they're sleeping, you know, because we're listening to people all around the world. And I know that a lot of people will end up downloading the archive to the show. And you can always post questions on the website. And I want to also emphasize that the discussions that we have on Blog Talk Radio, Homeopathy World Community, are for edification, for educational purposes. We are not giving medical advice to anyone. You always seek your caregiver for that information. But you could bring them questions, and the questions that you have, like you said at the beginning of the show, that people have a sensibility, an innate feeling that they should or should not do something with their health and or their children's health. And they, if they have that doubt or question, that they should really address it with some knowledge and information, and go ahead and study and learn, and then inquire to place these questions in front of their caregiver to see what other information is available. So I guess my question to you out of the box is this, you know, you said there's chapters on chickenpox, measles, mumps, and whooping cough. And I really, when my kids were little they did get chickenpox, but by that time, very few people were getting measles. I had measles and mumps, and now whooping cough is really becoming more epidemic, I would say, in certain areas of the country. So how does, for instance, moms talked about having a chickenpox party so that their kids would get it and build up their immunity and get it over with, and then they wouldn't have to worry about it for the rest of their lives. It was sort of like a coming of age kind of thing and a growth spurt. So now I don't hear about anybody getting chickenpox because of the vaccines.
Yep.
I don't know
this
how comes.
I live in Minnesota, and there is also within the population, or at least the alternative and the holistic moms groups, that sort of population, there is a request and a desire and an active seeking out for chickenpox for their children to be exposed to. And at least in my practice, I haven't seen too many cases of actual wild virus chickenpox, but what I have seen are cases of children who have not been vaccinated but then were exposed to somebody who got the chickenpox vaccine, and they actually contracted the disease from them, but it's the strain that's in the vaccine is not very virulent, so the immune system responds to eradicate the virus in the child that hasn't been vaccinated is rather weak, and actually we're seeing the child get sick without the eruptions surfacing, and then after a remedy or two is given that it actually strengthens the immune system, then we're seeing the full expression of the eruptions and the final resolve of the disease. There.
That's very interesting. I think probably we could talk about that, but it depends on what direction you want to take today's talk. For instance, a really big thing, and I think we're leading into this, is why should we examine the vaccines today and the way that they are being given? As you say, they're manipulated strains, they're not wild strains, and what is the difference whether they are or are not made in a lab or come from nature?
So I think there's three, maybe four main issues with vaccines. One is the nature of the actual viral or pathogenic material and how they acquire that. Two is how they incubate it. So what also is included in the vaccine, and that includes whatever the medium is, whether it's be aborted field tissue or bovine extract or yeast protein or things like that, or egg, depending on the vaccine, in conjunction with all the other adjuvants that are put in with the vaccine. So there's that, and then there's also the method of introduction of this now vaccine agent into the body, and mostly it's by injection. There are some now that are nasal spray, and I can talk a little bit about the difference between how that is. And with we had the oral polio vaccine, which has been taken off in the market because actually children were, the virus was still alive and then spreading through the stool, and people were actually contracting polio from children who were vaccinated.
So you say they took that off the market?
Oral polio one, it's available in some other countries where I guess they didn't want to destroy the batches of it or whatever, so they sell it at a discounted price to Turkey or Africa and places in Africa and stuff like that. I'm not sure where. So there's those three things. One, the nature of the pathogen, what it's incubated on, and the adjuvants. The method of inoculation, and then the final is the accumulation of many diseases given at the same time. Well, actually, then the fifth would be given into an immune system that is not able to comprehend that. So if we were to look at historically, the first vaccine to be made was actually the rabies vaccine. At the time, Louis Pasteur was working on how to make, well, Robert Koch had come out with his Koch principles, which are the Koch postulates, which is if you were to take the blood of an animal that was sick and inject it into a healthy animal, then lo and behold, that healthy animal would succumb to the same sickness that the sick animal had. And
mm-hmm.
through this deduction, they concluded that there must be some agent in the blood that was then transferred this way. And so this idea of taking the blood and then injecting it into another is carried through the current day vaccine model, except for, well, what Louis Pasteur was doing with the rabies vaccine is he was taking the blood of the rabid dog and then trying to elicit an immune system response in another, in a healthy dog, to rabies. But if he was just doing the direct transfer like that, these dogs then would be dying of rabies.
Mm-hmm.
So he took the blood of the rabid dog and tried it in sheep and tried it in horses and tried it in rabbits and tried it in pigs, and then injected back in dogs. And he found of all of those, when he took the blood of rabbits that had been infected with rabies and put back in the dogs, then the strain, the viral strain, had been weakened to an extent to where it still initiated an immune system response in these healthy dogs, but didn't kill them from rabies. And so this formed the basis of all attenuation models. And now we have vaccines like the rotavirus is incubated in pig intestine skin cells, you know. And we've got the hepatitis B vaccine and the MMR vaccine. These are now incubated on human aborted fetal tissue cells, which the viruses are able to replicate, and they're able to, and then it weakens the strain. They have other techniques to weaken the strain, such as radiation or taking apart the viruses or stuff like that. And then they're injecting it into the healthy children, hoping
mm-hmm.
to elicit an immune system response.
Mm-hmm.
And what we found, though, and what we see in our practice now, and what we know about the immune system, because this practice from Louis Pasteur that's like almost 150 years ago, we haven't changed the methodology of vaccination, but what we know about the immune system is so much more sophisticated and evolved from that, and that immune system response is a very complicated sort of cascading of events from the initial external exposure to localization to finally, febrile symptoms and then antibody production. And so the main problem we're seeing with vaccination is because they're injected straight into the bloodstream, the peripheral aspects of the immune system are bypassed, and that normal cascading of events that would lead to a healthy immune response are, negated. And so you get an immune system that's confused and tries to figure out, well, what am I supposed to do? How do I get rid of this? And so you see in children recurrent fevers or what they call ear infections, which is actually a localization of the vaccine matter, trying to find a vent to weigh out. And then these responses, because they're not recognized in the allopathic community as being actually a healthy response to this germ that's been injected into the child, but they actually see it as a form of sickness, and then so they're given antipyretics or antibiotics or something to suppress this now immune system response to something that's been injected in actually with the sole purpose of eliciting an immune system response. But anyways, it's all complicated now.
That sounds really fascinating. I'm sure that people probably don't put two and two together to realize that it is the immune system itself that is creating these forms of illness after vaccination, which is really actually healthy because the body is looking for a way to respond to these injections of matter into the body. And we're taking things like fever, which is a healthy response, a healthy organism response, and now giving them something to suppress that fever or take the pain, you know, when we just take the pain away, the pain is a signal to something much deeper.
Yeah.
So this is really, really fascinating. What other questions do people usually ask you at this point when you tell them of the different, you just listed a bunch of things about the natural way that a virus is, well, is introduced to the body. We didn't really talk about the mucous membranes and such, but you listed off a few things about the material that it's made and how it's incubated.
Yeah.
And
the other would be the combination of giving many different diseases at one time they've got, you know, 5 vaccines or 8 vaccines they give at one time in an infant's immune system that actually infants normally cannot develop specific antibodies. They know how to make a fever and they know how to make a localization, and slowly as their immune system matures, they're able to make specific antibodies. But in the normal way, it's not until 1 or 2 years of age that these antibodies are being produced. And so if you look at least, you know, each state is different, but the Minnesota vaccine schedule, by the time the child is 1 year old, they've had some 30 different doses of disease injected into their system, which the normal process includes an antibody response, and that's in a healthy adult's immune system as opposed to an infant's immune system. So you've had all these diseases injected in one after the other, and basically we just have to wait until the immune system is mature enough to know what to do with these agents to eliminate them, because actually all disease is an in-process and an out-process. There's the getting sick, and then the body processing it and then removing it from the body. And we need to see this response even from vaccination too. So if you're injecting something in, there needs to be some outlet through which the disease comes out, and you can see it in diarrheas, but more oftenly you're going to see it in with ear infections.
What specifically will we see with these diarrheas and the ear infections?
Well, it's one way that the body can eliminate the pathogens that have been injected into them, you know?
Okay.
And like measles, for example, it needs a skin eruption, actually, to fully eliminate that virus. And with the MMR vaccine, we're seeing the most problems partly because it comes after 25 other vaccines, and so by the time the MMR vaccine comes along, the child's immune system is already heavily compromised. But then the nature of the disease itself, if measles is given to an individual with a suppressed immune system, instead of the eruption surfacing on the skin, the virus goes to either the gastrointestinal tract or the central nervous system. And so what you'll see, and what some other doctors like Dr. Andrew Wakefield and independent researchers have replicated this, is that they'll find measles viruses shedding in the guts of children who have vaccine damage from the MMR vaccine. Or what you also see, if those eruptions aren't coming to the surface, they can go into the nervous system and the brain, and what you'll see is some kind of encephalitis or head banging or what we call brain cry, which is where the inflammation is pressing on the brain and causing, you know, neurological dysfunction like that.
And we have many, many cases of this, and it's documented, and I typically go toward the social political questions. You know, why the medical physicians and researchers, if they're seeing such a high statistical rate of these occurrences, they're not looking more closely. I think that they are, in a way, that they're trying to reduce the offending materials. But still, I think it's a combination of what you said of bypassing the body's natural way of getting immunity and injecting it in, and the multiplicity of numbers. You're just shocked me to say that they've had 30 vaccines by the time they're 1 year old?
Well, it's 30 different doses. So there's 16 different vaccines.
Uh-huh.
And then of each, like a hepatitis B, there's four of those. Of the DPT, which is three different diseases, there's three or four of those. And then if they get their annual influenza, and then there's polio, which is two or three doses of that, and then three doses of pneumococcinum, and then we have rotavirus, and now hepatitis A, and the varicella is in there, and meningococcinum, and Haemophilus, which has four doses of those. So between all of those added up, it's like 28 or 31 doses or something like that by the time they're 12 to 15 months of age.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you have seen results of the aftermath of all of this. Okay.
So it's between the voices of my parents who haven't vaccinated their children and the voices of those parents, and actually my own conscience of looking at these children with vaccine damage, is that we have to do something different. Mm-hmm. We cannot continue with this madness. I have a very simple sentence that if any doctor would start to think about it, and that is that if we are to take multiple disease agents and inject them into a child's immune system with the intention to elicit an immune system response, we must be able to determine if the responses we're getting are the desired response. And somewhere along the line, you know, the CDC says only those reactions that happen within 24 to 48 hours after the vaccine are considered vaccine reactions.
Mm-hmm.
But we know that, say, you or I are exposed to one disease, it might be 2 or 3 weeks before our immune system makes a response to that disease. And each disease has a different prodromal period of its nature. Measles is a 10 to 14-day response time. So it would make sense that if you give the MMR vaccine, that it's going to take 10 to 14 days before their immune system is going to make any responses. And usually what would happen is, 2 or 3 weeks after vaccines are given, then the child gets sick, but the parent takes the child to the doctor and says, oh, this doesn't have anything to do with the vaccines, it must be something else, so we just give antibiotics. And then the antibiotics go for 2 weeks, and then the next week they're coming back for their next shots. And so the cycle is just pressed one on top of the other, and there isn't any breathing time in between for that immune system to relax and to not be in process with some disease agent.
Can I ask about breastfeeding? Because I think that mothers in particular decide to breastfeed for the immune potency that they are getting through the mother's milk, and it seems that if they want that to really culminate in a healthy child at the end of a year of breastfeeding, what's happening with the vaccinations during that time?
Right. Well, it's actually interesting. You know, they did a study in India in the slums with rotavirus vaccine, and they noted that those children that weren't breastfed produced a greater self-antibody response. Means that those children that were breastfed, because the colostrum that's coming in the mother's milk provided antibodies for rotavirus, that the infant's immune systems weren't stimulating the same level of rotavirus antibody.
Mm-hmm.
So their conclusion was that women shouldn't breastfeed.
Oh, my gosh.
Want these, the child to make their own antibodies. So it is true that, I don't agree with the conclusion at all, it is true that children will remain healthier if they're breastfed by a mother who has those antibodies. Now, the thing of it is we're about 3 or 4 generations into vaccinating, and the antibodies produced from vaccines are short-lived. They're 1, 2, 5 years, something like that. So chances are if the woman was vaccinated as a child, by the time she's breastfeeding, unless she had those diseases naturally, she's not going to be passing on those antibodies because, you know, unless she gets booster shots, per se, and actually that's the current methodology is to get adults, you know, mm-hmm. reboosted with all these vaccines. So, but it opens up a discussion which we don't know the answer to, and that is antibody response synonymous with immunity?
Mm-hmm.
And 'cause what we're seeing is we're getting, sure, a definite elevated antibody response in these children, but we're seeing so many other aspects of their immune system in dysfunction, heightened allergies, behavioral learning problems, skews in mental function and that. So, yes, we've pushed these antibody response, but these other symptoms, they must be an expression of immune system function. Because I can say this, because when we treat a child with homeopathy, and we treat them as if they have vaccine damage with remedies that relate to either the diseases in the vaccines or to helping their immune system balance itself out, then these mental, emotional, developmental expressions and allergic symptoms go down as their immune system begins to become more functioning and able to develop a fever and pass through that fever. So, I just think it's very interesting that we're not recognizing these this whole other cachet of symptoms as actually being representative of some level of the immune system and immune system function.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this answers our initial question of really a lot of questions, why we should examine vaccines, because we really don't know how effective they are, how long-lived, whether even in the adult or the child, how long the immunity lasts, whether they can be passed on from mother to child, what are the other ways that the immune system is expressing an outlet from the ingredients in the vaccine, whether there are mental, emotional, allergic symptoms or neurological damage or gastrointestinal problems, which we're seeing in a much greater rate today, ADHD, ADD, all of these types of things. And so, you know, I'm even thinking in my mind, what about all of the women who are diagnosed with fibromyalgia today? Could it be related to vaccination boosters that they've had going through, having to go through high school or college or travel, these kinds of things? Do we really know the extent of the expression of the body after having a vaccination? So what would you like to impart? You want to talk about how homeopathy will play a role here?
Yep. So just in one little response to what you're talking about, the fibromyalgia there, it's what I see, it's unresolved disease expression. So whether it's actually from an actual disease, like, say, somebody got pneumonia and then they never really recovered from that and their body is now aching and paining and, you know, headaches and things like that. It's like a subacute phase of that disease.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see it with mono, you can see it with influenza, but you can also see it from they had a vaccine and the some sort of immune system response was supposed to happen or it partially happened and wasn't completely resolved. And actually what we see is that the development of chronic disease, per se, is highly advanced through the suppression of acute disease. So we know this in homeopathy. So the corollary is true, is that if an individual is able to experience acute disease as an exonerative process that it is, it actually is liberating the body through the process of fever purification from the toxins and accumulations and actually liberating chronic disease from its greater manifestations. So
that's a mouthful. I mean, you could, probably that could be taken apart and really understood more thoroughly for those who are new to the thought process of Hahnemann, Samuel Hahnemann, the founder of homeopathy, to really understand what the beauty of the human body is, this organism that is constantly attempting to keep us alive, and when we are attacked by all of these different agents, what it does to, as you say, liberate the body through these purification processes. So that was really beautifully stated, and hopefully we'll understand that a little bit more. So now, how does homeopathy come in to this?
So, you know, when I wrote my book, I really had the perspective that if we were to treat each individual with constitutional homeopathic care, which actually these remedies would act as exonerative entities, means that when you give a remedy, sometimes you get an aggravation, but often you get some kind of a discharge and an amelioration of the constitutional state of the individual. And that was really my approach, and then thinking that, okay, if disease comes along, then you can actually treat the active disease. And through my research, I found in some situations that, yes, these remedies were actually able to prevent the disease, or if there was exposure, you could give that remedy, and it would facilitate the disease instead of it normally being 10 or 14 days experience, that you could actually speed it up to be just a 3 or 4 day experience and lessen the sacrifice on the individual. And so this is really the approach I had until after writing my book. Then I had the opportunity to travel to different parts of the world and see what was happening, and I was introduced to Dr. Isaac Golden, who had been working with homeoprophylaxis since the mid-80s. Now, homeoprophylaxis is the systematic use of nozodes in a sequentially over time, and their nozodes are remedies that are made from the disease agents, and we'll talk about that in a little bit because we opened up the discussion talking about the attenuation and the problem with giving the crude disease, you know, and how far. Anyways, so we'll come back to that in a minute. But what I was fascinated by with his results was that these children who had undergone the homeoprophylaxis program were actually healthier than children who had not been vaccinated but who had received constitutional homeopathic care. And this result kind of left me dumbstruck for a moment, because I had always gone on the belief that constitutional care was what keeps people healthy. Mm-hmm. And so I started thinking, what's happening? How can exposure to all these disease nozodes in a sequential process stimulate a greater level of health?
Mm-hmm.
And we touched upon it just moments ago when we talked about the idea that acute disease actually liberates the chronic disease state. So experiencing an acute disease, which is an infectious contagious disease, which is marked by a fever, rapid onset, and either spontaneous resolution or death if the fever is too high, like that's one option. Okay, so acute disease is saving the individual from chronic disease. So if we're giving, if we go back to look at vaccines, well, giving all these vaccines clearly isn't saving anybody from chronic disease, because it's producing a horrible state of chronic disease that these children are in for years on end, and all kinds of therapies and all these different things, you know, autism and all the DAN therapies and chelation and behavioral modification techniques and all these things. So clearly that mode of imprinting disease agents into an individual is not liberating them from chronic disease. But with these results from Isaac Golden, it's like, what's happening there? What's So what I came to understand was that if you've been given the disease in a dose that's comprehensible, that the vital force can work with, so that it actually goes through the process of the disease in a dose that's not so strong enough as to kill the child, right? But enough to stimulate an immune system response, that actually the cumulative effect of this is that the child evolves and the child's immune system grows and is stronger, and it's actually able to support a greater level of health than if left alone. So there's many people who say, yes, let's get chickenpox, because we know that natural exposure to chickenpox is actually going to increase my child's health. And people will see this. Oh, after the child went through the chickenpox, yes, now they're riding their bicycle or learning to read, or they're engaging in much more thoughtful conversations or things like that. That clearly that disease, it wasn't just a disease process, but it transformed the child in a way. And you can see that with measles, and you can actually even see it with whooping cough, too, if the disease is not too strong. Now, the thing of it is oftentimes disease itself, it's too strong. And so then it can leave a mark, and it can hurt the child, and or the child could die. You know, some children die from measles or whooping cough like that. So,
And this is what brings fear into the parents, you know, especially if there's an epidemic and other children are getting sick, and people are either losing their hearing or some debilitation or death.
Yeah.
So how do you answer that?
So with the systematic use of the nosodes, so we start with Pertussin, which is for whooping cough, then pneumococcinum for pneumonia, then Lathrus, it's actually not a nosode, for polio, and Haemophilus influenzae, and follow through the protocol that's actually listed on my website. That's vaccinefree.wordpress.com, and it's under the status sheet. So going through these nosodes, it's given in a dose that the vital force, the immune system of the child, can understand. So all of these remedies have been diluted and diluted and diluted, so the original substance is passed out of the solution, but the frequency or vibration of that substance is left. And what happens when a child takes this nosode is it's recognized, so it's oral, it's taken orally, so we're solving the problem of injection. First, we're solving the problem of attenuation, because it's been diluted and diluted and diluted. It's not been radiated or pulling apart or genetically modified or whatever it is that they do.
Or put in another, or put into another living animal.
Right. Yep.
Which
it's
is
the,
that's,
it's, yeah. it's either it's the straight pathogen that's been cultured, or it often does come from the sputum of a human that's been sick with the disease, like measles is from the Colflex spots inside the mouth, or influenzinum is from the cough and sneeze of somebody with flu, you know. Anyways, but it starts there, but then it's attenuated into an energetic frequency. And that frequency, when taken orally, is sufficient to stimulate the most peripheral aspects of the immune system, which in turn, the cascading effects of this immune system response, that after a time of taking these nosodes over repeated weeks or months or the program that we have, actually antibody production begins to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've solved the problem with attenuation, plus we're doing one disease at a time, so the immune system can only needs only to concentrate on one kind of immune system response. And then because a child's immune system isn't yet ready to make antibody production, but certainly its peripheral aspects of the immune system know how to be stimulated. So we're stimulating these peripheral aspects with this energetic dose. And in the end, we're seeing children that they're getting effects, momentary effects from taking the remedy. Sometimes you get a fever, sometimes you get a runny nose, a little loose stool or something as a discharge. The body's behaving as if it's been exposed to the disease. but there's no actual disease material present because it's been diluted out. But this process is purifying or tempering the child's immune system so they're getting stronger and healthier.
Mm-hmm. Can you just refer again the peripheral aspects of the child's immune system are getting stimulated, which are constituted by the production of a fever or a discharge or a rash or something? Is that what you consider peripheral aspects?
No. So if we, you know, our material view of the body would see that the skin and mucous membranes and even the cells that line the lung or intestines, because they're actually technically outside because they're hollow organs,
mm-hmm.
those would be the peripheral aspects. But we know in homeopathy that Samuel Hahnemann talks about this sort of, if you walk by somebody who's sick, there's a slight magnetic maltunement that happens from an influence of the other person. It's not necessarily that a germ jumps through the air and infects you, but somehow that the frequency of them disturbs your own frequency.
Mm-hmm.
That, to me, I see as the most peripheral aspect, and it's in the energetic realm. But
mm-hmm.
for those of us that maybe aren't ready to think so much in the energetic realm, we could still just say the peripheral aspects are those superficial mucous membranes. So
okay.
because we're taking it orally, it's touching, you know, just upon the saliva in the mouth.
Mm-hmm.
But because the immune system has it, it inhabits the body like a web, and
mm-hmm.
that it's not located in one particular place, but that when something is twanged in one area of the body, the whole system changes in response to that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And
yeah.
then in turn, specific antibodies are produced. And then when those antibodies are produced, then the body develops a discharge to eliminate the antibody-antigen complex. And so that's either through an eruption, so we see that in chickenpox or measles, or through the stool. You can have diarrhea coming like that, or through sneezing, coughing, like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I just want to give you a time. We have about 10 minutes left to the show.
Yes.
And it's been really fascinating, I think, educational and eye-opening for some people if they've not been familiar with the system of medicine, homeopathy. But, you know, when you talked about what Hahnemann in his Organon spoke about, the energy of the body and how just being in the room with someone or passing by someone, there's a magnetic attraction or repulsion, or that something can be malattuned or disordered. If you know, there are many, many studies today that show that happiness is contagious, that depression is
yeah.
contagious, that all of these types of emotional imbalances, that when somebody walks into the room and they're filled with anger or stress, you can feel it in the air. It's not
yeah.
something like a germ that does have to actually jump across and get sneezed
yeah.
on or whatever. So I think most
well,
people can really
like,
understand it.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Like sudden shock, or like when 9/11 happened, it was such a shock. It was
mm-hmm.
such a traumatic event. A lot of people got sick from that. Or say, example, if you failed an exam at school, I mean, the amount of stress that went into study for it and then the letdown of failing, the body can fall into sickness too. And it can look like there's a germ there, but
mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily believe that the germs are the cause of disease. They're more the result of the disease. They just show up when the situation's right.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yeah.
Right. And you know what? I really do believe that the medical arena is beginning to see and understand this, as they say when we do the meditations, that they do say a high percentage of illness and disease is caused by stress.
Yep.
So they are saying it in their own way, but what you say in terms of the germs show up as a response to disease, to disorder or
yes.
illness, that is a twist of a turn that they haven't really gone that corner yet and,
yes.
and understand it completely. So what would you like to say in the last few minutes of the show
yeah.
today?
So since the writing of my book, excuse me, then I have had the opportunity to travel around the world, and this homeoprophylaxis program, which is clearly delineated on my website, is available throughout North America. There are supervisors underneath me. We're doing a research project where we're wanting to replicate Dr. Isaac Golan's work into North America, and it's going to take 5 or 10 years to show. And we have about 70 or 80 children already enrolled in the program, and they're going through it like that, and we're getting some good results so far. But
mm-hmm.
since my travels, too, the program is extending beyond here in North America. It's getting initiated in Japan. I was just there. I was just in India and have been setting them up there. And in each different location in the world, I was in Serbia this springtime and setting it up and continued to spread the word. It's getting set up now in Portugal. It's available in the Netherlands. With each
mm-hmm.
different country and each different locality, there's different needs. So in India, we looked at, okay, what's happening seasonally with the rains? Typhoid's always coming. Typhoid is actually a vaccine that they have in the vaccine schedule there. So we can add Typhoidinum into the series on a seasonal level like that. In Japan, they have concerns of Japanese encephalitis. So we're adding that, the nosode of Japanese encephalitis, to the program. And in some places, like in the program was actually run in Colombia, South America. It's not through me, but through another man, Dr. Jamie Alexander Mora. And because he needed to satisfy the local government, he gave every nosode of every vaccine or the disease that copied the vaccine schedule. Here in North America, I don't include hepatitis B because it's a sexually transmitted disease and the infants, I don't think, need that disease. I don't include diphtheria because there's no incidence of diphtheria in it. I don't include chickenpox because I think kids should get chickenpox naturally. I don't include influenzinum, but it is an optional addition for those individuals that live in northern climates or are concerned about the flu. You can add it in seasonally. And then don't include hepatitis A, but it is optional, too, for those individuals where their child goes to institutions where there might be a risk of foodborne disease. Anyway, so the program can be adapted to and is being adapted to all these different needs for based on the environment, the seasons, the disease relevance and exposure, and so on and so forth.
It sounds quite extensive, and I'm wondering just the response of the governments. You've talked about so many different ones around the world.
Yeah.
How does it compare when you go to places like Portugal, Netherlands, Serbia, Japan, India, South America? We're living in North America, and I feel like we have a lot of pressure in other ways to get vaccinated. So what kind of response are you getting here?
Right. Well, so here in North America, we are lucky because we have, in many states, a personal exemption. And currently, because the program is not established to a large enough scale yet, and I'm hoping it to be taken up by a university or somebody who's willing to put their name behind it, I mean, I am, but somebody on a much larger level so that it would gain recognition by states. I'm hoping that, when it comes to that states might be willing to accept it. I know locally here in Minnesota, parents are taking their status sheet to their daycare providers or their school and even taking it to their doctors and showing this is what I'm doing. It's met with, that's interesting. That, I had a woman from California call who's a principal of a school. She says, we've got three or four classrooms for autistic kids. I'm having a baby. I don't want my child to be autistic, and I'm going to take this program. And she would, in that school, she would accept anybody doing any alternative or any sort of disease prevention program. It's acceptable for her.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's how we can work it here in the United States. In other countries, it's more complicated, and it depends on the legal role of homeopathy. In India, while homeopathy is very well backed by the government, and they've got huge branches of the government which oversee homeopathic schools and stuff like that, the logistical problem of actually patient compliance is going to be hard to overcome, and I've left them with that. How are you going to solve that? Because most of the patient, the population is uneducated, illiterate. You know, you can't necessarily give them a program to take home and expect them to do it. So is it that they would come in like the first Sunday or the first Monday of the month or whatever is going to be the day that everybody gets their doses, come into the clinic? So there's different parameters. So there is no problem to be for it to be overseen by the government or on that level, but the logistics of it are a different thing to manage. In Japan, because they have there has to be a separation of remedies administered from the practitioner, means that the remedies need to always go through a pharmacy. So in that situation, the practitioners can't oversee the program. Or they maybe they can, but the patient needs to be getting the remedies from the pharmacies. So there's mm-hmm. just so many different parameters, and it has to do with the exposure of homeopathy. In Serbia, they're just doing it. It's the vaccines are mandated. There's no exemption whatsoever, but they're just doing it because mm-hmm. they're used to running a black market in Serbia because they've been under communistic oppression for all these years. So they're just, you know,
mm-hmm.
each place is different. And I was introduced to somebody. I was just in India teaching at the Bombay Hospital, and a woman came up to me after. She's from Yemen, and she runs a hospital. She says, it's the only country in the world where the pharmaceutical companies have not entered. There's no vaccine program there whatsoever, and I can do what I want. And I'm
mm-hmm.
going to take this program, and I'm going to just do it, you know, exactly for the needs of that country there.
Well,
so,
this is really quite fascinating, and you've given us a lot to think about. I would like to help, you know, get awareness about your program and what you're trying to do in the world.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Just say your website one more time, and then we're going to probably close out the show and start up in a minute with Grant Bentley and facial analysis.
Okay, great. So the website is vaccinefree.wordpress.com.
Mm-hmm. Okay, vaccinefree.wordpress.com. Take a look over there, and I'm going to post it on the live chat. I thank everyone for listening. I'm going to close out today's show and maybe bring you back another time. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Debbie, for having me. And
thank you for listening to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio with homeopath Debbie Brock and special guests. We encourage you to follow our show, favorite the show, click the reminder button to receive email notices when shows air, share with your friends on Facebook and Twitter, send in your comments and questions. See you the next time.